Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the show, we're going to be speaking to Perry Tykert, who is the author of a mystery novel that has just come out, and the Meow Wolf Gallery people are standing by. But first, Linda Siegel is here, our KSFR's legislative correspondent, with a late-in-the-session legislative update. What's happening?
Well, good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning.
It looks like we might have some more updates because I think a special session is imminent. The governor yesterday vetoed the big capital outlay bill, which has about $350 million of statewide and local projects in it. And he said that if he doesn't get a health reform bill that he likes up there today at 12:01, that he'll be calling him back for a special session.
Have we had a special session lately?
Well, let's see. I believe we had one last year, which was called immediately after the regular session, and that's when where the Senate kept adjourning and trying to go home, and the House stayed in. So who knows what's going to happen this time.
So tell us more about this veto.
Well, the veto, the reason the governor said he vetoed it is because they got it up to him so early that he only had 3 days to look at it, and it's got about 2,000 different projects in it. I mean, I think the reality is that everybody's playing political hardball, and there's another capital outlay bill almost just like this one that the House already had from the Senate, which they're going to go ahead and pass up today, and then he'll have 20 days to sign or line item veto that. So it's just the legislators and the governor and the House and the Senate disagreeing with each other, and the Senate and the governor disagreeing, and we're just going to see what happens.
And everybody is tired and over-caffeinated, no doubt.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there were some other things that also haven't happened, like no ethics bills.
So no ethics bills. We have a veto of the capital outlay. We have
no health reform.
No health reform. Do we have anything at all?
Well, a few bills have passed. I think we can talk about them in our wrap-up next week. But a couple of domestic violence bills, a human trafficking prohibition bill, a few other things. And, of course, in a 30-day session, really the big deal is the budget. And the budget did pass. The budget got up there. It's a $6 billion budget. The governor line item vetoed only about $15 million out of that. So the session has done what it's supposed to do, but it didn't do everything that people wanted it to.
So you will be with us if and when there is a special session with continued KSFR legislative updates, but we also will do a wrap-up when it's all over. Linda Siegel, also the domestic partnership bill.
Oh, yes.
Didn't pass.
Nope. That was the one that passed the House and died in the Senate committee, and there were some attempts to revive it, but they didn't really work.
Well, Linda Siegel, thank you so much for being with us, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
I would like now to welcome, sitting with me here in the table, Vince Cadlubeck, Matt King, and Quinn Tincher. They are from Tincher, which...
Tincher.
I said it right. Who are from the Meow Wolf Gallery, which is brand new space on 2nd Street, opening today. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello.
Hello.
So this is a small but highly concentrated, potent little art space that I went to yesterday, and it was being painted from floor to ceiling with art on the walls as well. What's the concept of this space?
Meow Wolf was created as an active response to the boring and elite art world of Santa Fe, and also an active response to the boring and way too expensive bar music scene in Santa Fe also. And so that's the general idea, and it's to give a place to young 20-something artists, or young at heart artists, to just kind of go crazy with and to not be limited by any sort of creative or artistic definition.
So all of you are artists as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
So what kind of work are you doing in there right now? How would you describe it to our listeners? They said in unison.
Yeah. It's a difficult thing to describe in words. You saw it.
Yeah, I would say it's sort of like a messy, chaotic, organic fullness of expression.
Yeah, it's all encompassing, definitely. You walk in, and when you walk in, you're not looking at anything on the wall. You're really walking into the heads of Quinn and myself, and sort of getting a taste of seeing the world sort of through our eyes, you know, which is probably really different from what most people are used to seeing if you walk into it.
So, you are painters. How would you describe your artworks?
Well, I do sort of an illustrative comic book style, and Matt does more of a free-form abstract style.
Yeah, I really focus on mainly color balance and fluidity, not anything in particular I'm trying to depict or get across. It's more of just me sitting down and doing it. It's a very spiritual thing for Quinn and myself.
And so there is, and what about you, Vince? Are you an artist as well?
I write. I'm also, like, I do some film stuff or some video stuff. You know, I'm a conceptual thinker and systematic executioner. So,
executioner.
Executioner.
You're the first executioner we've had on the show.
Of numerous things. So yeah, I mean I'm not part of this show. This is Quinn and Matt's show specifically.
Yeah, we definitely wouldn't be able to do it without Vince at all.
Yeah. And so, not just Vince, but everyone else involved in Meow Wolf has been very dedicated and very helpful to Quinn and myself.
And so you have art that will be for sale, and also the space itself is a work of art.
Right. Yes.
And you will be changing the shows, what, every couple of weeks, couple of months?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably going to be like a three-week on, three-week install, three-week on, three-week install. So it's probably like a six-week cycle, I would guess. That's kind of playing it by ear right now, though. It's totally an organic thing.
And what's the concept for the musical part of it?
Basically, it's like, well, I mean, the art side of it is really nice because it's like going to create this environment, you know, it's going to create the environment for the venue itself, which is going to evolve for every show. And then the music venue side of it is basically like, you know, we have 30 days in every month to book as many shows as we want to book. And we have myself and a guy by the name of Matt Smith, who is a very experienced promoter of music shows. And we both kind of just like we know bands, we know booking agents, and we wanted a space to be able to book music shows that could house a good amount of people. You know, we're currently, our last night was our last night of a music venue called Meg's House, which was like kind of an underground basement house off of Sierra Vista Street. And we closed that down last night. Last night was the last show, and we're going to start doing all our shows at Meow Wolf now.
And so what type of music are you planning on having there?
Everything. I mean, electronic.
Everything. Chamber music.
Yeah, I mean, electronic, hip-hop, indie, classical, punk,
I think
whatever.
It depends more on the artist involved than
right.
necessarily
totally.
Like the genre
totally.
Of music. If the person shows the dedication and the passion
right.
that the other people involved in Meow Wolf show, then they can definitely play.
Yeah.
This is an all-ages type of situation?
Yes, definitely.
All ages, no alcohol.
Right, yes.
Yeah. Wholesome.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. Kind of.
Yeah. Sort of. We're definitely promoting self-growth through creative outlets is really a main focus.
Yeah. I mean, we really want Meow Wolf to be a place where people don't just come and observe being alive. We want them to come there and actually do things.
Participate.
And sit and, you know, cut out stencils, you know, weave hats, do whatever.
Anything,
do something.
Anything. Right. Be involved.
How did you all become artists?
I don't think became artists.
Yeah.
I think that art kind of became us
yeah.
along the way.
Yeah, it's
I don't sit there. It's not me that does most of the painting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really this long road of self-discovery that upon discovering ourselves that art comes out. And when you actually sit down and do it and you don't think about it, then it's just flowing through you. And then you sit back and look at it and you observe it, and it's amazing. And it's not anything that we really put our minds to do. It just happens.
I think that it has to do with being a quiet human being as well. I mean, we're surrounded with so much constantly that we can purchase and pay attention to and be distracted by, that if a person is actually quiet and chooses to filter a bit of that out, they're all artists. Like, that's the art of actually being alive, and the byproduct will be beautiful no matter what.
It's interesting, because when we were talking yesterday, we were talking about the fact, yesterday I had a person on the air named Stena, who came up during the New York avant-garde in the 1960s and early 70s in New York City, where everything was sort of free and inexpensive, and there was a community and people had time. It seems now that nobody has time to get involved in creative pursuits unless they have a lot of money. How are you guys doing it?
We're dedicated, and this is what we believe in. This is how we live, and so this is what we live for. So we'll do anything that it takes to do it.
And yeah. cheap living. We all live incredibly, you know, with you know, completely humble and without, you know, like, paycheck to paycheck. We only spend the money that we have on the things that we need, and so that we have an amount of time. You know, we don't have to spend all of our time working.
Yeah.
You know, there's free time.
And even living, like, in a meal-to-meal fashion, as yeah. many of us do, passion is a lot of our life. And
yeah.
we don't really need as much of everything else.
Right.
And we don't sit and watch movies. We don't sit and watch TV. We don't drive around for hours. We do things with our hands. Well, you get paid for it.
Yeah.
I found it fascinating that you told me yesterday most of the people involved in this are from Santa Fe. Most of them did not go to college, and there is a freedom in that because you don't have college loans.
Yeah, all of us, actually. There's none of us went to college.
I believe I'm the only person that didn't grow up in Santa Fe, and, yeah, none of us went to college.
And we just sent, like, a couple of people, like, taking classes at community college. But, yeah, like, they're definitely not the burden of student loans to pay off.
Well, and beyond the financial burden of college, there's the social burden of college as well. I mean, we're self-sustained human beings who've specialized ourselves very much so out of necessity. And it's that specializing and our want of artistry that, you know, it's that combination that's led to where we are now. And I think that with the microcosm of college, we wouldn't have created that. We'd still be wondering how to do laundry.
I wonder, I mean, is there, obviously, if you go to college or art school or whatever and study art, there's things you learn, but I wonder if there's, do you find there's an intellectual freedom in not having that, or is it something that you'd like to pursue?
I think you learn a lot of dogmatic phrasing in art school. You learn how to define, you know, gestalt. You learn all of these rules and definitions for things, but if you just don't pay attention to that, you know what you like. And if you base everything off of knowing what you like, then it doesn't matter if anybody else likes it or not. You know, and I think that
it's about expressing yourself and really finding out the best way to do that. And art school, college, I guess, can help in that some way, but not really when you sit down and you be by yourself and you be quiet and you look inside of yourself and you think about yourself and who you are and the way you see things and the way you want to express yourself. No one can teach you that.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I mean, I was thinking about it after I left the gallery yesterday. Have we come to this funny moment in our cultural history where going to college is more financially and intellectually burdensome than not going? I mean, that's not something that the grown-ups will tell you.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not bashing college education. I think that it's incredibly important. But it's the non-specified version of college education that really gets me. It's a bureaucracy that makes you work through a certain system that represents ideas that were developed an incredibly long time ago, both artistically and educationally. You know, I believe in technical education. You go, if you want to learn to be an oil painter, you study just oil painting, and that's it.
Now, how are you planning to reach out to other young people in Santa Fe? This is notoriously not really a young people's town at this point.
Dance parties.
Yeah, music shows.
Dancing.
Yeah, definitely.
Just
fun.
By doing what we're doing.
The overall energy of the art that's up. Yeah. I mean, just like, it's already attracting MySpace.
Through the past 2 weeks of Quinn and I doing this, people have stopped by, friends and friends of friends, and every person that walks in is amazed. And you can look on their face, and you can tell that they're thinking something that they have not thought before.
Yeah.
And that's what pleases us the most, is that we can look at them and tell that they're thinking something. I'm not sure what, but it's something. But it's a new thought pattern.
Right.
And that's what we need. That's what
the second they walk in.
Not Santa Fe. That's what everyone needs, is a different mindset.
The Meow Wolf Gallery is at 1403 2nd Street. It's on the same side of the street as Cloudcliff, but closer to Cerrillos. How did you name the gallery?
the group of 10 of us that chipped in and started the whole thing sat around a coffee table and put two words we really liked in a hat, and we all drew them out, and through a process of voting and applause meters.
Yeah.
Eventually, we came to Meow Wolf.
Some other ones were the Vibe Hut.
The Vibe Hut. The Wolf Palace.
Wolf Palace. I Ship.
The I Ship I like.
Yeah. I now sign a lot of my MySpace bulletins and emails with I Ship. He's kind of taken on he's now a guy who does PR and marketing for Meow Wolf.
We also got the name of our show that opens tonight, Meowzors, was another suggested name.
Meowzors. Yes, I was enlightened into the inner circle of people who know what Zors are yesterday. Tell the greater multitudes.
It's a modification of Zorus.
The Dinosaurus.
Dinosaurus as opposed to the Thesaurus.
Yeah, but you could really add it to anything.
Yeah.
Kafazorus.
Breakfast Burritozors.
Burritozors.
I mean, it's a very elite club that does the Zors thing. Really.
Not anymore.
Hey, wait!
Yeah,
I thought you were an anti-elite art.
Oh yeah, no, we definitely are. We definitely are. I mean, we're talking about two or three people who throw the Zors around, and Emily Montoya and Benji.
Yeah, I think
specifically.
So, how many people are involved in the Meow Wolf Gallery at this point? The three of you.
Yeah, and about seven others. About 10 total, I would say. And and like you just said, we're totally open for as many people who are interested in coming and creating collaboratively to come on board. And we're looking for sound artists and mixed media artists, film, video, any sort of artist to come in and build these full environments with us. Yeah, totally open for whoever wants to be part of it.
And it's also something that you'd like to have not only artists doing installations and so on, but when an installation is built, people could use it as a film set if they are making a short film.
Yeah. They can even, and if somebody even wanted to use it to shoot a short film and had a specific set that they needed, I mean, we could work with that.
Could,
I mean, anything creative that can go in
even
there.
Even just portrait photography.
Yeah.
It's an amazing location for portrait photography right now.
Very interesting.
Performance theater. I mean, the list goes on.
So this is happening at 1403 2nd Street. There's an opening tonight from 6 to 11.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's going to happen tonight?
Well,
you guys are still painting and doing it.
Yeah, we've actually been up all night. We had to take a break to come to the interview today. and then when we go, we're going to get back on it.
But tonight, it'll be Matt and myself sitting around in suits handing out Valentines and some chocolate and smiling and humming a bit. And there will be some people playing music.
Some people will be playing music.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
A group called Bull Seal.
Bull Seal,
yeah.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here. Vince Cadlebeck, Matt King, and Quinn Tincher. Anything you want to add about Meow Wolf before we go?
I would like so much to thank everybody who donated paint or money or food or rides. Yeah, Matt and I would not be able to do this. Yeah. We've been locked in the studio for 2 weeks straight, and without our friends, we would not be alive.
Right, we wouldn't be alive.
And thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Oh, yeah, and thank you.
And for the opportunity.
I would also like to thank my family who drove from Texas today and is sitting in the car listening to this. That's great.
I'm probably cheering right now.
Well, thank you all so much for being here. It's been great fun, and we look forward to seeing where this Meow Wolf Gallery space goes.
Thanks. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Pari Tigert. She is the author of 3 books, the newest of which is The Socorro Blast. Three mysteries.
Yes.
Welcome. Although it's nice to have a mystery that's not a murder mystery.
Thank you for noticing that. Yeah.
So you will be speaking at Borders here in Santa Fe, Borders on Zafferano. When?
It's Saturday, this coming Saturday, and I believe it's at 2. It's either at 2 or 3.
I was trying to find my paper last night. Ladies and gentlemen, you'll have to call Borders on Zafferano because I could not find the information here or on the internet. But anyway, I thought maybe as a Valentine's Day tribute, you could read the first paragraph of
my
novel.
As a Valentine's tribute.
Or Valentine's Day celebration, what would you call it?
Well, you know, it's a little cynical for a Valentine. If hell exists, it's filled with old boyfriends and a cat. I added another bandage to the 3 bloody lines of mismatched adhesives now adorning my right forearm. Shocked from a sound sleep, Leo DeCat had inflicted the scratches in retaliation for my abrupt waking from yet another nightmare about hitherto heartthrobs, including unremembered heroes like the guy with the baking soda white hair and the new grass green eyes, or the one with the banana soft face and lips the size of plump tomato worms. So she's had a bad love life.
She has had a very bad love life, indeed. This is your third mystery starring Sasha Solomon,
yes,
our heroine, who
our
writes
heroine.
In the first, speaks or writes in the first person. Tell us about this character.
Sasha's a baby boomer. She's fairly prickly as a human being.
I should say.
Yeah, she has a very different take. She's a native New Mexican. And she loves New Mexico, and she's figured out this way to make her living and still, you know, and be able to travel all over the state. So what she does is she goes to little towns and she helps them with tourism. She's had a miserable love life, continues to have a miserable love life, has a very complicated relationship, as many women do, with both mother and siblings, sibling, and also is just really funny. She's very witty, and so everything that she sees and notices has this sort of quirky, slightly sarcastic edge.
Which continues to amuse us on almost every page of the book. I mean, one thing that I've always liked about her is that she eats whipped cream straight from the spray can.
You know, I was in Wetumpka, Alabama on Sunday, and I thought I'd gotten over this sort of the whipped cream lady thing. And I was in front of 150 people and television camera, and the host of this event walked up to me with the whipped cream can and said,
no.
Do it.
No.
You know? So it's like I'm going to always be the whipped cream lady, at least for this series.
Now, isn't that funny? Do people sort of think that you are your heroine?
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes that's wonderful because I think she's a really interesting person. I'm married. I have kids. I lead a normal life. Sometimes it's difficult. With this particular book, some of the views that my character has are not, absolutely not, my views. But it would be untrue to have her have my views.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's a fictional character.
Yes, thank you very much.
But it is funny. I suppose that happens with actors, too. People, you know, come up to whoever, Robert De Niro or whatever, and think that they are the character
they
that they play.
It. Absolutely. And because I'm a young, I'm a baby boomer and so on and so forth, and I have a similar build, and Sasha and I, we share biographical information, but we are extremely different people. I think when writers first start out, especially in fiction, they write about themselves, and hopefully they get that out of their system and can have independent characters. And
now,
it
did
took
you
me a long
do
time.
That?
I did.
How did you get through it? Was it in the Sasha Solomon series, mm-hmm. or was it before that?
Well, it was in the two full manuscripts I wrote before that that never sold and that deserved a long, slow death. I had to get it very much out of my system, and I had to write about, I'd say 800 pages to get her out of my system.
Really?
And create an independent character.
But it was still this... It was still
Sasha.
And so you wrote two whole entire mysteries?
Yeah. Her name was Sasha Sipowicz at the time.
Uh-huh.
We refined it a little bit. Because that was, still when NYPD Blue was on, at least in reruns and stuff. And I thought Sipowicz sounded too close to whatever his name was. Or no, Sasha Stigowicz was her name instead of Sipowicz.
So this Sasha Solomon... Well, first of all, she's had a terrible love life, but she does, for the first time, have the first appealing boyfriend of her life who has decided to move away.
We met him in the last book. We don't like him for this. Well, no, we're upset with him. Sasha certainly is upset with him. He's a wonderful guy. He's intelligent. He's got a decent job. all of these things. And he's good for Sasha. He's stable. And he's decided to go to Maryland to the Institutes of Health.
So the book begins with a blast in which Sasha's niece, Gabriella, has her hand very badly injured in an explosion that was in her mailbox. She opens her mailbox to get her mail. Her hand is practically blown off.
Her hand and arm. Yeah.
Her hand and arm. And first this was thought to be simple vandalism, but pretty soon it starts looking like a hate crime.
It does. And the thing about this book, I write, people can read my books. If they want to have a light, witty read, they can do that. But my books always have deeper themes, and I'd say that this book is the meatiest and most multi-layered of the books I've written. And the hate crime issue, the whole book is about intolerance. And I explore it on multi-levels, and one of them is possible hate crime or not. And Gabriella, one thing that's important about her, even though it doesn't sound Iranian, her last name is Shofet, which is an Iranian surname. And she is part Iranian.
So she's half Iranian, half Jewish, and neither of those things is Arab, but people are calling her an Arab and a terrorist.
And a terrorist because she's at New Mexico Tech, and she's studying chemistry and explosives technology, which is the same field her father was in.
And I have to say, one of the more amusing things was right at the beginning of the book where Sasha likes this niece because she's the one most like Sasha.
Yes.
And she liked her ever since she used her junior chemistry set to blow up her older sister's birthday cake.
And Sasha really, really dislikes Gabriella's older sister. Sasha cannot stand Daviel. She cannot stand her. And Daviel is in the book for a while, and Sasha's merciless in her perspective on Daviel, who happens to be an Orthodox Jew. That's Sasha's sister is an Orthodox Jewish woman, and Sasha just does not get this. And she thinks that Daviel embodies every horrible thing about it possible, because, we are most frequently hard on those closest to us. On our family, within our religious group. That's where we're hardest, and I had to be true to Sasha on that.
And so, there's so many layers of intolerance, as you say, in this book. And, Sasha's not particularly tolerant toward her sister or her
Mm-mm.
or her niece.
Mm-mm. No, and it's not admirable.
Yeah.
It's not admirable. And I really thought long and hard before I did this. And that's why we have book discussion questions in the back. And it's also why my sister, who has a PhD in education, and I have developed a curriculum. I'm hoping this book might be used in colleges. To explore intolerance. And we developed an entire curriculum that professors can use to, each student would take on a particular character and then have to go on the web and find out how to be tolerant, would have to learn how to be tolerant. So we'll see. It's in its infancy, but people can go to my website and look at it.
Amazing. Has anybody used your book that way before?
No, I know that my book's been used in some Southwest Studies kind of classes before. But this one, I'm really hoping that that'll happen with this one.
So, we don't want to give away the
mm-hmm.
book.
No.
So we will not do the book. But we can talk about some of the themes in it. Even this... reporter who is a friend of our hero, Sasha Solomon, and she's very beautiful, very ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
She's a TV reporter. And even she is framing this as you know, your Iranian niece. I mean, she's second generation American.
Yeah, and Sasha keeps saying she's American as apple pie, you know, because Sasha's trying to defend her reputation. One of the things, I don't know if I told you this before, but right after 2003, right after we entered the war with Iraq, I received a postcard from Langley, Virginia, offering me cell phone minutes to Iran. Okay, it was a telephone company called Primus. It's now in McLean, Virginia. And after I thought, oh, well, this is a weird marketing campaign, I mean, I went through several different iterations before I thought, oh, my goodness, this is intelligence phishing. And I started thinking, if that's the seed for this
book. Why did they target you?
I have no idea. Because I have an Iranian surname. But to me, it's, or not surname, I have an Iranian first name.
Oh, your first name.
Pari. First name. So somebody did a database search. To me, it's akin to searching Ian to sell Guinness.
Right.
You know, I mean, it just, and it blew me away, and I was so flipped out about it.
Well, one thing, I mean, is intelligence gathering. Another thing is wanting to sell you stuff. I mean,
no,
it's not quite
fishing.
On the same level. Yeah.
This felt, it may be that it was just really targeted, but I'm a very bad candidate for anything to do with cell phones. I don't even know how to answer my cell phone. So, I mean,
at least you have one now. Last year you didn't have one.
My father-in-law bought one for me. All I know how to do is call out on it. I probably have hundreds of messages. I've never retrieved them. I don't know how to do it. So, you know, I'm not a good candidate. So I get this postcard. I go through thinking, well, is it targeted marketing? Is it intelligence phishing? And I never could get rid of that uncomfortable feeling that it was intelligence phishing. About a month and a half ago, so 5 years later, four years later, a month and a half ago, I got the second kind of mailing that's similar to this. And it's a company that's based in Washington, D.C., offering me Iranian legal work.
Oh, my goodness.
So I just don't buy it. I do not think that this feels
it's
suspicious
just
to me.
Niche marketing, yeah.
So, you know, you were talking about Bailey, the reporter.
Right.
And with what happened with 9/11 and everybody knowing that some of the guys were trained in a little town in Arizona to fly planes, this could be, you know, for Bailey, this could be her launch into national stardom. And it's very easy to fall back on stereotype and generalization when you're hungry and when you're looking for a good story.
And when your subject just had her hand blown off, or almost blown off, her arm by an explosive, and she's an explosive, a student
she's
of
an expert.
Explosives.
She's, yeah, and her there's a family history because of her father. And she's not that well known in the community because it's her first semester. And so all of these things, you know.
We're talking to Pari Tykert, and her book is called The Socorro Blast. So talk more about, I mean, one of the things that was interesting is this tension between the traditional and you know, observant Jews versus completely secular, you know, bacon-eating, bacon,
right,
lettuce,
right,
tomato sandwich-eating Jews.
Biscuits and gravy kind of gal.
Yeah, yeah. And really both, I mean, there's this interesting moment where both Sasha and her sister argue that they are more free than the other. The traditional one thinks she's more free, and the non-traditional one thinks she is.
That's actually one of my very favorite scenes in the book. I love that they actually talk about it. You know, and some people who identify with Daviel or with Eva, Sasha's sister, get very angry with how orthodoxy is portrayed. But if you look at the book as a whole, you see that Sasha actually changes through the book and listens to her sister, which is something amazing for Sasha to do because the family relationships are so fraught. I got an email from an Australian reader who said, you know, I am as different as I could possibly be from Sasha. She said, but reading your book was difficult for me. And she said it was difficult because it's the same issues. I face the same issues in my family, just different religion. And I believe.
What was her religion?
I
she
didn't
say?
Dare ask. No. I mean, I'm sure it's some kind of Christianity.
Uh-huh.
But you know, you see it in every religion. You see it among Muslims now, where they're what are considered extremists. I won't say Orthodox people are extreme, but that's how some people within Islam see it, and then the very liberal ones who, you know, believe that women should have equal rights and everything else. You see it with any organized religion, and I explored it in Judaism because that's what I know best. But I have met Jewish people who are very observant, who look at their Reconstructionist or whatever, siblings or family members and cannot understand it and think they're lost. And I've seen super secular Jewish people look at their Orthodox family and think that they're lost and just not get it. And so I wanted to explore that.
And it has so much to do with gender roles.
It does a lot. I mean, last night I was at the Jewish Federation of New Mexico's big fundraising event for women in philanthropy, and I was interviewing Faye Kellerman, she's a mystery author, and she is Orthodox, and her characters are Orthodox Jewish people, and her books are all about Judaism, and, I mean, they're wonderful books, but I thought it was just very interesting. Even the Jewish Federation of New Mexico had me, I'm raising my kids Jewish. I'm much more Jewish than Sasha is, obviously. But had us conversing. We didn't get into, it was to spotlight her, and so we didn't get into some of the issues I would have been interested in discussing with her.
You told me that some of your readers have given you a hard time.
Yeah.
And they really objected. I was reading the book with that in mind, and what did they object to?
They don't like how Orthodoxy is portrayed. They don't
specifically?
They don't like that Judaism is not, there's not a happy face. That's a shorthand, but it's true. You know.
But they're happy. The people who are the Orthodox people are perfect, especially the sister.
Yes.
Sasha's sister mm-hmm. is perfectly happy with her life.
She is. She's very happy with her life. And they don't like the potential divorce, even though we don't know if that's going to happen, or the betrayals. I mean, there are people not acting at their best in this book. I believe that's...
How different from real life.
Well, see, that's it. But there are people who... I think what happened is they don't like that Judaism is not portrayed in a positive light, although I would argue that it is.
I would argue that it is, too.
And I think that the people who were closest to it get angry about that. They were upset with Daviel and how Sasha sees Daviel. But I'm sorry, that is how Sasha sees Daviel. And Daviel is not a sweetie either. I mean, she really isn't.
And she makes a major screw-up.
Oh, she does several.
Yeah.
She does several. And I think they get a little irritated because Sasha makes a comment about Daviel and Israel that is not a generous comment. And... A lot of Jewish people are extraordinarily sensitive about Israel, and rightly so. I think, I firmly believe that Israel should exist and should exist in peace and not feel threatened by all of those countries around it. But I also believe that you look at everything and see the good and also places where improvement can be made or at least discussed. But, I mean, it's kind of to me like gun control and guns. I was very knee-jerk about guns for a long time. Then for research, anti-gun, absolutely. Mom, just, absolutely anti-gun. Didn't understand it, thought everybody who had a gun was a freak. It was right there. And then I went to this thing called Firearms and Fiction, and I met a lot of people who love guns, and I learned a lot about guns, and I shot guns. And while I would not own one, I get it.
Yeah.
And so I'm quiet on that issue now.
Yeah, I guess every mystery writer should have a little bit of familiarity with guns.
Well, this is the Second Amendment Foundation. They put you up at a hotel in Las Vegas, and they teach you all about guns, and then they take you out for 8 hours the next day on a shooting range with, 20 kinds of guns, and you shoot them. So you learn about kickback, and you learn about all these things. And it was very different. For me, it was right after President Bush had just won the election, and I was not a very happy camper. And I was at a cocktail party where everybody was, they were bad-mouthing liberals. And I just said, look, I'm here on a cross-cultural exchange. I'm a liberal. If I can be here, you can talk to me. And it worked. We had a cross-cultural exchange.
We're talking to Pari Tykert. The book is called The Socorro Blast. Let's talk about the craft of mystery. How do you build in all the clues as to, you know, who's done what and all of that stuff without making it too obvious and just giving it all away? I mean, the careful reader will get those clues, but you can't let them know exactly what's happening.
You have to give just as much. I was going to say, I have no idea how I do it, but that's not true. A lot of it happens in the editing, because I'm one of these organic writers who writes the entire book and then goes back and fixes everything and then goes back again and fixes everything. With Boleyn, my second book, when I went back and I read it the first time, I realized without even consciously doing it that I had set up an incredible something. I mean, I was just like, I read it and I went, oh my God, I'm brilliant. I had no idea.
You unconsciously set up
something
thing.
Great. But usually I go back and put in clues and then I look. You have to play fair with your audience and with your readers. And, you know, I have people who are coming to mystery for the first time or reading it for very different reasons. And then I have people who are avid mystery readers who read 300 books a year, truly. And one of the things that makes me happiest with this new book is nobody saw the end coming. Everybody I've talked to, no one has seen it coming. And that just makes me delighted.
But then if you were to reread it, would you then see the clues, do you think?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Absolutely, you'd see them. But I did it well enough that people it flies by. It's part of, you know, part of the story, and they don't catch it.
There's also a supernatural element.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit. We have a ghost appearing. We have one of Sasha's best friends is a psychic who calls her in the middle of the night with premonitions,
premonitions
and things like that.
Yeah.
I just sort of wonder, not so much the psychic thing, because there are psychic people, but it's not clear that there are ghosts that come and sit on your... Or are there?
Well, no, I mean, it's very interesting.
Have you ever experienced that?
Not that. But, I mean, it's interesting to me that I have people come up to me and say, a ghost wouldn't do that. In Clovis, I had a ghost in the Bosque del Apache where he should have been in Clovis, right, or in Portales. And I've had people come up to me and correct me on these things.
Ghost behavior specialists?
Yes. You know, and it's like, first of all, it's fiction. You know, even for people who are experts or supposed experts, it's fiction. Second of all, I live in New Mexico. How can I not have a supernatural element? I'm sorry. I'm a native New Mexican. Thirdly, I believe that there's a lot in this world and beyond our world that we don't know, and I prefer to live in that magical place. Fourth, I adore Darnda, who is the psychic, and I'm working on a new series, and she is front and center.
Oh,
and
really?
Yes, she is, and she's affectionately known as the Bug Whisperer because she doesn't do people. So in the Sasha series, when Darnda calls Sasha up and has a premonition, for people who read the new series, they'll understand just how close of a friend she is, because she just does not like doing people. She doesn't like going in people's minds. They're murky, and they always have bad things in them. And she prefers to deal. She can't. She doesn't like to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she prefers?
She prefers animal. She prefers, you know, she can talk to anything that's living or once was. So, and animals and bugs and black mold are just a lot more straightforward to deal with.
She can talk to black mold?
She can talk to black mold.
So I guess she gets hired.
Well, she works for a television show called Psychic 911. And she goes on the job, and they film her, you know, getting rid of the black mold or keeping bugs. In the first book in the series, she's keeping bugs away, you know, pests away from an outdoor wedding. And, you know, I mean, so that's her specialty. You know, she says, I could talk to your rosewood desk, but why would I? It doesn't have much to say. but the conceit of that series is the fact that it's not words. You know, she says, I talk to them. But any clue she gets, anything she gets, is from this creature or essence's perspective. And a lot of them don't have eyes or words.
Now,
or
are we going to... This isn't the end of Sasha Solomon.
Oh, absolutely not. No, the next book... I'm writing the next book in the Sasha series, and that takes place in Las Cruces. And it's called... Currently, it's called The Las Cruces Heat. And it's going to... I found that I write to themes. You know, like this one, Scoroblast is intolerance. Las Cruces Heat is about the chili pepper industry, about sustainable agriculture and food politics.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I'm doing with that one.
So we have the Clovis incident, the Boleyn hitch, the Socorro Blast, and we're having the loss. So you have, like Sasha Solomon, you go from place to place in New Mexico, and not necessarily, I mean, we don't have a Santa Fe one, at least not yet.
No, probably
won't. You go to places
off
the beaten track.
I go off the beaten track, which is, I mean, and Santa Fe has been done and done well by, like, Walter Satterthwaite and
right.
other people. So same reason I wouldn't do Taos. The next one after Las Cruces, if I do another one, will be in Farmington, and we'll look at the energy industry.
Mm.
So, and I do. I go to the places. I stay in the hotels. I eat at the restaurants. There is. I'm going to just give a plug for the San Antonio General Store, which has the best fudge that I know of in the state.
Really?
Other people can
Sasha
send me fudge, and
too.
I can I can sample it if anybody wants to send me fudge. But really good. Yeah, they have like 7 to 14 different kinds of fudge in this little dinky store in San Antonio, New Mexico. Yeah, Sasha knows this, and Sasha would be the one who'd eat more fudge than I would.
She would eat more fudge, and she would probably put her
whipped cream on it.
So, you're a native New Mexican.
I am.
Have you, I mean, all these places that, you obviously have to research them further, but are these all places you know, or is this really
no.
a discovery for you?
No, and I try to go to places I don't know well, because I have to see them through Sasha's eyes. And Sasha's in public relations and marketing, and so she goes with a very particular perspective. In Berlin, I remember when I wrote that, one of the newspaper reporters was not happy with how I portrayed Berlin. But when you drive into a downtown area and buildings are boarded up and you say you want to increase tourism, I'm sorry, from a public relations perspective, that doesn't jive. In the Socorro Blast, the main drag in Socorro is a north-south street named California. Now, Sasha finds that tremendously funny. I mean, she does. She's just like, there's no sense to this at all. And then there's no signage to get to the plaza, which is one of the main tourist areas right in Socorro proper.
Right.
I should say the Socorro Blast is all of Socorro County, which was really fun for me. I fell in love with that county. Took my kids everywhere, and we stayed in the hotel. I mean, we did it.
Yeah. And I guess you probably had to learn a thing or two about explosives as well.
I did. And because of my experience with that postcard, I did all of my research. I made contact by phone, but I did all of my research in person because I was just paranoid enough that I did it that way.
You mean you didn't even want to leave whatever
cookies
cyber trail might happen?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
No. And I don't think I'm being overly sensitive to that. I mean, I met a guy at that Firearms and Fiction, I met a guy who trained TSA people, you know. And I said, am I being paranoid because my name is Pari, that somebody's going to stop me at the airport or something like that? And he said, no, you're not being paranoid at all. You're not being paranoid. And he said, I just want to give you a perspective, though. He said, I teach people to shoot guns all over this country. He said, I don't have anything. I have no piece of clothing that doesn't have residue, gunpowder residue. He said, I get stopped all the time. So it's not, you know, just to put it in perspective, I'm not being overly paranoid, but I don't think it makes great sense to go online and search for explosives. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think that makes great sense.
Yeah, unless you figured out how to leave no trace, which
there may be, but I'm not savvy enough
to
do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, mystery writers, what do? We learn how to kill people. I mean, I know lots and lots of ways to kill people. I know how to kill. I mean, I can't kill anybody now. I can't kill my husband because it would be too obvious. But I know ways to do it untraceably and so forth because I now have all these wonderful sources. It's great.
How do mystery writers learn about that? And also, How do you learn about that?
Well, there are reference books, and they're pretty good.
For mystery writers?
For mystery writers. There are all kinds of reference books. And then what you do is you start asking around, and this person knows that person, knows that person, knows that person. So, for example, with the explosives, I ended up talking to a guy from the bomb squad, at the Albuquerque bomb squad, and the FBI guy, whom I will not name, who is known as the fireman, who got me a guy to talk to because of a contact. You know, somebody I knew at my Taekwondo dojang. Knew someone. But that's how I do it. And I have a source who's known as the Poison Lady, who is a pharmacist and a ER nurse. And she, whenever I have any questions about poisons, I go to her.
Amazing.
You know, I mean, yeah, it's great.
So if you want to commit the perfect crime, just start writing mysteries. And after 5 or 10 years...
No!
Well, what
don't
is
do your research.
What does it do to you as a human being to have all that knowledge?
Nothing at all. What does to me more than anything else is I remember interviewing a homicide detective and walking into his, it wasn't an office, it was sort of a cubicle, and seeing all of these folders and knowing that every single folder represented a tragedy that wasn't just one person's tragedy but was many people's tragedies. And so I try never to treat death and crime lightly. Some people can. Donald Westlake does these wonderful caper novels. You know, they're stealing. They're not murder. But I try to have respect for that because I try to remember that death, I mean, murder is a heinous crime.
Okay.
Oops. Murder is a heinous crime, and it needs to be respected as such.
Well, I think that may be our signal that it's time to go. But Pari Tykert, I'd like to thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it was a delight.
Pari Tykert's latest book is The Socorro Blast. It's a Sasha Solomon mystery published by the University of New Mexico Press. And she will be this Saturday at Borders on Zafferano, and we think it's at 2 o'clock.
We think so. You can find it on my website. You can find it at Borders. So
okay.
It should be okay.
What is your website?
My website is parinoskentyker.com. But you can key in any of my book titles, Clovis Incident, Boleyn Hitch, Socorro Blast. Find me that way.
Yeah, because that will make the spelling situation easier.
Yes.
Pari, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Dan Pyburn is sitting in today with a special Valentine's Day show. And then on Sunday, the forum on KSFR will feature guest moderator Greg Bemis. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow is Friday. Robert Knott will be here. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody. Hasta mañana. Thank you.